This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, March 7th, 2012. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, going beyond erotic love. In Washington, D.C., at the Folger Shakespeare Library, there's an exhibit up called Shakespeare's Sisters, Voices of English and European Women Writers, 1500 to 1700. As part of the project, a number of contemporary poets were commissioned to write poems in response to women writers who never got much attention during their lives and who are often still neglected today. A few weeks ago, we heard Yvonne Boland's homage to Anne Bradstreet. And on this program, the second of three podcasts on the topic, we're going to hear Heather McHugh responding to Gaspara Stampa. Gaspara Stampa was born in Padua in 1523, and her poems were published only after she died by her sister. She first came to the attention of most contemporary poetry readers and to Heather McHugh because Rilke wrote about her in the first of his Duino elegies.
It turns out, actually, she's not the wimp he makes her out to be. If you ask me, actually, she's a fairly feisty lady. She's a 16th century poet. She died, as I recall, just about 10 years before Shakespeare was born. She was a madrigal writer, some say a courtesan. Her father died early, which prompted in her mother an interesting move. She moved the two girls and the son from Padua to Venice, where there was a thriving art scene, salons, the earliest printing of books was going on, especially of madrigals. And she and her sister were exquisite singers. So they held salons, and aristocratic guys came by, and she became obsessed with one of them and began to write these poems. He had airier views of the relationship than she did. She had pretty fiery ones. And ultimately, the poems pass through stages of sorrow and come out to do something that you see in Shakespeare's sonnets, too, namely to claim that even though the love will not be achieved, the triumph is in the art, and that that art will outblaze the love and prove somehow what he can't see.
So it was unrequited love.
Yes. Well, the love was unrequited. I think the lust was not.
Ah, well, that's complicated.
If I may make that distinction.
Yes, that is an important distinction to be made. Huh. Now, you have translated, I don't know how many of her poems you've translated, but I have in front of me one of your translations of a sonnet. Before you read this poem, is there anything that would be helpful to know about it?
Only that she's obviously, in the course of this poem, still in love with him, and most of the poem is dedicated to the praise. However, the wanting element, which is ascribed also to a celestial body, appears at the end.
Okay, why don't you give it a read?
Sure. All these stars and planets gave my lord some essences of theirs upon his birth. They gave him powers only heaven could, investing mortals with immortal worth. Saturn lavished all the depths there are of knowledge, Jupiter the peaks of skill, while Mars instructed him in ways of war, and Phoebus how to turn a phrase at will. By Venus, made as handsome as refined, by Mercury quick-witted, twice times three ignited, I've been burning for his mind. Alas, it's only cold he turns to me, the tune so icily consistent with his moon.
Wow. The line that strikes me is, ignited, I've been burning for his mind. That's not a normal expression in the sense that you're usually burned for somebody's body. You're hot
yeah.
for somebody's body. But in her case, no, she's got his body. She doesn't have his mind. Right?
Yeah. I mean, his true attention, his love, is what's wanting. He visits her and then is off promenading around the countryside on his charger. And you can feel that through many of the poems. I adapt fairly liberally when I'm translating because I want to preserve the music, but I also do want to preserve the spirit of the sorrow. She's clearly a lively, fiery woman, and she was reported to be very lovely, and he clearly took advantage of that. As I say, it's sometimes said she's a courtesan, others say not. This mother did an ingenious thing educating these girls, considering she had no resources, that they had been semi-noble and had fallen from that state after the father died, and also her brother died. So these three one woman and two girls were left. And that mother must have been something of a tough broad herself.
Mm-hmm. So after you didn't read her because you were turned off by the impression that Rilke left of her in your mind, when did you start reading her, and what has she done for you?
I read her because the Folger Shakespeare Library was planning an event called Shakespeare's Sisters and asked us to peruse some examples of work by women written at the same time. And Stampa was the one that grabbed me, being myself a woman who struggles like her, not only to express but to understand love, and like her, a woman of lively mind and heart who finds herself drawn and sometimes quartered, too, by her own unwelcome, sometimes unwelcome irrepressibilities of passion. Mm. I was born in August, blazing all the way, and I've always been attracted to a cold intelligence. Hmm. So I'm way too easily icicleable to death myself. And even now, my spiritual schooling, my aim, I'm interested in the three kinds of love, and I've been working hard a lot of my latter years and aided a little by the diminution of the natural faculties, in a kind of pursuit of one of the other forms of love, Eros, I myself enjoyed to the hilt. But I'm really interested in caritas and agape. Agape, there's no hope for us mortals of reaching, but which I think is a form of divine love or something. But caritas, I'm really interested in. It's a kind of Buddhist way, I guess, this attempt to understand love as a thing that you feel with a certain amount of disinterest. I don't mean uninterestedness, but true disinterest, what you want in a good judge or what you want in a real love, a comprehensive love. It's a cooler love.
It's compassionate love, though.
Hey, don't give away my last line.
Okay.
let's
get to your poem, which has the very funny title of Not Over It. Why did you call it Not Over It?
Do you think it's funny? I'm so glad you do, because not many people would even imagine ways in which it might be funny.
Oh, but it also bears the epigraph. Not epigraph.
It also
bears a little epigraph.
My students always get up and say, this poem, they're at their first readings, they get up nervously and say, my poem has an epitaph. And you want to say, never were truer words spoken. Not true. I have wonderful students.
Well, here's the epigraph.
Yeah, this is a kind of would-be Buddhist feels sympathy with Gaspar Estampa.
Okay. Why don't you give it a read?
Not over it. And I do take that to be, there's always permission to laugh. As far as I'm concerned, in poems, I hope they give us permission. Otherwise, they bore the hell out of me. But this one is a little serious exploration that then has its moon or title. The thing hanging over it says, not over it. By women so touched, so pressed. Here I should mention that there's a kind of embedded meaning in the word stampa that means press. Uh-huh. And since the press was getting such a foothold in Venice at the time, it struck me as a kind of central thing. But she didn't refer to that very often. She did, by the way, in her own poems, refer to him as a high hill, a cold high hill, or a high person, a person of high airs. And his name was Col Altino, which means high hill. Mm. So she would make that kind of play. And it's in ways like that I sort of pay homage to her, or famage, let's say. By women so touched, so pressed, detachment, being thought achievable at all, is boggling in itself. It's being thought achievable by love, but love for only all, not just a single sentience, appears the precept of too cold a form of flame. How much of a hand in things relinquishes the hold of things at hand? What kiss might such a mind reclaim? A swirl of dust in Buddhist schools, a view of solar systems from above, not love. The thought appeals as it appalls. Slow learners, we must spurn the selving sensualities to feel for feelers of this kind. Unfasten passion's burner to identify what's under it. in short, must court dispassion just to be compassionate.
So you're talking about a moving away from Eros into a different type of love.
Yes, moving, say, beyond it, not necessarily past it, I hope. So far in my 26th year of marriage, one, you know, still bumps and grinds a little in the creaking bed. But I really am crucially, the fewer moons you have left, perhaps the more crucial that moon seems. Not the uncompassionate cold of an arrogant mind, which apparently was Cole Altino's problem and many I've met, and myself in my youth. But something else, you know, a love for creature life, a love actually that doesn't so easily assume the mind knows its categories, that animals are less sensate than human beings or at our disposal, or that intelligence is inherently more lovable or beauty more lovable than something else. That's not true. One's heart changes. One's heart enlarges, I think. And you work on that. I mean, all long marriages work on that to some extent, if they last, I think. And I work on it as almost a daily sort of spiritual, carnal cum spiritual matter. I mean, she was provocative to me because I understand the flaming, but I am really also interested in a cool that is not cold, a cool that is a comprehensive love.
And do you think she got there? Do her poems reveal that she
died very young. I mean, she died, as I recall, at 30.
So this dispassionate, compassionate love that you talk about is not necessarily a function of age. It's something that could be achieved by anybody.
Well, I think, yeah, time is no obstacle in a way to anything. Many people do all the vertical movement they need to do in a life at the last split second of it, no matter what time they die. Other people are working on it all their lives. Since I was born, I've been working on death poems. You know, there's some people who dig their vertical way into things. I'm using vertical as a kind of figure for investigating the depth of being somehow. This sounds maybe fatuous to people who hate all those words like spirit and stuff, but some people get that vertical depth by digging slowly all their lives. Maybe that's the kind I am or something. You know, when I wasn't busy burning, I was trying to dig and figure things out. And, you know, there have been great minds in, thank God we have libraries and time to look back at people in time. And that's what you can talk about any artist in the present tense, because the work moves you now. You know, you say Shakespeare moves me. Shakespeare says, how lucky for us that, you know, we survive our 20s. How lucky for me that I survived mine. But there are many in their 20s, I think, who achieve it fast.
What I really want to know is, what does your husband of 26 years think about all this?
He doesn't think about flaming and spirit and all that stuff. That's one of the reasons I picked him. Two of us in the household would be unbearable. No, he's of the cool intelligence order that is very useful when you need to call out a question from another room, you know. You know, plus he's very pleasant to have in bed.
Okay. We'll have to end on that note. Heather McHugh, thank you so much for your time.
Yes, thank you too.
You can read Not Over It and many other poems by Heather McHugh on our website, poetryfoundation.org. Not Over It is also in the chapbook Shakespeare's Sisters, Women Writers Bridge 5 Centuries, edited by Gigi Bradford and Louisa Newland, and published in conjunction with the Folger Shakespeare Library's exhibit, Shakespeare's Sisters, which is running until May 20th. Let us know what you think of this program, where our motto is,
the thought appeals as it appalls.
Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.